When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
Welcome, listeners. We're back again with another episode of So Very Wrong About Games, where we talk about board games. My name is Michael Walker. I'm here with my good friend, Mark. How are you today?
I'm very well, Walker. How are you?
Great.
Some important stalag-related updates. We talked last week about stalagmites and stalactites.
Gotcha, yes.
And helpful patrons showed up, and they repeated, and I think this is important, they repeated the standard mnemonic in English, which is that stalagmites might grow from the ceiling and stalactites hold tight to the ground. Oh, wait, no, that's backwards. And you know why I pointed out that way? Because that was a coherent sentence that I uttered, and thus I think the mnemonic is not good. The traditional mnemonic, I remember the mnemonic. I remember that one might do something and one might be tight, but I don't remember which one's might and which one might be tight. A very helpful listener pointed out that in French, it's much better. Stalagmite monte. Stalactite tombe. And so I have no difficulty differentiating them. I will always remember, thanks to that. Another listener pointed out a slightly better version of an English mnemonic is that stalagmites are the ones on the ground, G for ground, whereas stalactites are C for ceiling. Now, of course, that relies on you being able to spell them, which is a bit of a reach. And by you, I mean the universal you. So far, I think what we've established is that traditional English mnemonic, no good. Spelling-based English mnemonic better, French mnemonic best.
And the other thing we've established that on our next medical emergency, we'll be all set, thanks to that. All right.
Medical emergency?
What, you don't need that information during a medical emergency? First, we're going to talk about the game we reviewed exactly 1 year ago. Then we're going to talk about the games we played this week. Then some news and why it doesn't matter. And then our topic of the week, which is game mastery.
So, you reach the end of a tunnel. Do you open the door to murder the goblins on the other side? Everyone check for perception. Oh, I'm sorry. This is me being a game master.
Nat 20, let's go.
So, our as yet unnamed retrospective intro segment, The Eurus, is Rolling Heights by John D. Clare. I thought about it. I thought about it carefully. I think Rolling Heights is my favorite John D. Clare game.
I think the end of Rolling Heights is my favorite John D. Clare game.
Yeah, so... For those of you that remember, Rolling Heights is his tiling city-ish kind of game where at the end of it, you destroy the city by dropping a gorilla meeple in a disaster dexterity endgame of a 1v-all scenario. It's so iconoclastic as a way to end a game. It's brilliant. I think that more games need to really lean into wild swings like that. I think it's unfortunate that more designs don't do truly bizarre gonzo stunts of that nature. I was reminded, I talk about this all the time, of Dragon Valley, which was an I split you choose game. And one of the problems with I split you choose games is it takes a long time to decide how to split, because mostly splitting is an opportunity for errors, not really usually a good opportunity for exerting strategic control. That's one of the reasons why Rainer Knizia's Marabunta is so good, because splitting there is actually powerful. And so people would often take too long. And so the Kickstarter bonus exclusive for Dragon Valley was a dexterity game that the other players would play while the splitter was making up their mind and gave you the opportunity to score a very small amount of points while the other person... More games need dexterity versions is the upshot, I suppose, and or wild swings.
Yeah, so that's the what you remember about Rolling Heights. What you don't remember is the actual game, which is
It was
fairly
fine.
Bog standard tile placement.
Well, you got to roll meeples. That was something. It was a little cute.
True. You're going to get points based on where tiles are and what they're next to. And it has very cool looking sort of glass cubes that you stack up and make these buildings. And like you say, you roll meeples. And depending on how they lie inside your box, they're flat or on their heads or standing up properly, you get, you know, bonus action points.
So we sent Rolling Heights to a listener very shortly after the review. I don't think either of us regret losing it from the collection. I'd be willing to play it if somebody suggested it, but I will say the following things that I remember about Rolling Heights above and beyond the end game. The end game is spectacular. I do remember that unlike most other city building games, you do end up with something resembling a skyline. It's kind of neat, vaguely evocative of an actual city-ish, almost, not really, but quite. And it's okay because... I'll just say it. City building games usually leave me feeling cold. Like, everyone's played good city building games in a computer or video game version, right? I mean, whether it's SimCity or anything else, there's lots of really great ways to build cities. Board games are kind of lagging behind, I'll say it.
I want to get back to Megalopolis. What's the dexterity one where you build those very artistic looking buildings and then you have to slide them into place and make that crazy looking city? That was a great game.
I disagree.
Oh, you didn't like it?
It was all right. I mean, it's mostly just the premise.
It was called Mega City Oceania.
I'd rather play Rolling Heights.
I meant for the visuals, right? You said it made a great looking skyline. And when this game was done, man, it looked pretty interesting.
Yes, but no, that actually highlights what I'm talking about. I don't mean like a cluster of interesting things to look at. What I mean is there's areas of densification, there's areas of low density, there's a sort of sweep that you would find in an actual city skyline. That's what I mean. Like, yeah.
An actual urban area.
Yeah, well, Mega City is like... Here is the downtown core of a city with lots of skyscrapers, right? That's fine. That's cool, too. Visually interesting. I'm talking more about something vaguely evocative of an actual city, right? Most of the other city building games, we're playing them, it's like, there's nothing to differentiate this from any other tiling game. I could have been laying tiles for the countryside of Carcassonne. I could have been laying tiles of, you know, downtown Mumbai. Doesn't matter. It's all the same. But Rolling Heights gave you at least some visual touchstones of densification and less density and other things, and that I appreciated. But we don't regret getting rid of it.
No.
That is Rolling Heights by John D. Clare, a prolific game designer who some people really like, and I don't generally see the appeal. So
there's no card crafting in.
I know.
Rolling Heights, really.
It's
weird.
True. I tend to prefer his designs where he doesn't do card crafting, honestly. I mean, Rolling Heights and Cubitos are probably my two favorite John D. Clare games, but that's not saying a whole heck of a lot. So, that is the Ayuris. Now onto the games we played last week. Walker, what did you play last week?
Mark, I played a bunch of Harmonies on Board Game Arena. This is very, I don't want to say Cascadia-like because it's not a terrible game.
Woof, shots fired.
Unlike Cascadia, you have your own cards that you're trying to fulfill. And a little bit like Azul, there's a pool of different wooden discs that are different terrain types in the center that you're going to choose from every time it's your turn. You're going to choose a group of three different terrain, or they could be all the same, but a group of three terrain tiles, and you also get to pick a animal card if you have room for it. I think you can have four at the top of your sheet. And on every animal card, there's a place for maybe three or four cubes that will be ascending scores if you get the cubes out. And the way you get the cubes out is to build these habitats with these wooden discs. And it'll show you on the animal card, you know, the type of terrain. It's like reminiscent of that animal, right? If it's a turtle, it'll need like a grass, water, water, or an otter will need grass, water, or a monkey will need a tree that you need two brown discs and then a green disc on top for a tall tree, and then maybe something
else.
Okay,
that one you got me.
Yeah, there's
your otter and turtle stories were not holding up. But.
There's some that have buildings, like a clay building, which would be like a wood piece and a clay and then a stone on top. You can make mountains by stacking three mountains on top of
each
other.
Can you build actual buildings and then get raccoons?
I haven't seen all the
the urban carrion eater expansion.
All right. So you build these habitats and then the card will tell you where to put the scoring cube actually in that habitat, which matters because you can sort of interlock these habitats. It's like, for my example, otter needs, you know, grass, water, and turtle needs water, grass. I could use those discs. Yeah. But if where the cube goes is the same disc, then they can't interlock that way. So it's all these sort of interlocking habitats that you have to get together. And then at the end of the game, there's yet another puzzle that you're doing, because how you place all of these discs will score you more points if you have like mountains all grouped together, or a long river, or all these different ways that the discs could score.
Are you building your personal biome, yes, or is it shared?
Okay. No, it's your own.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Looking forward to getting a physical copy, which is ordered. This is designed by Johan Benvenuto and published by Liblud Harmonies.
Well, Walker, I had an opportunity to play with some children. I don't have many opportunities for this, not ever since the ruling. And I tend to have a very, very bad understanding of what children are going to take to. This time, though, I was more successful. I actually thought about it very carefully. And indeed, I wasn't the primary one responsible for bringing games anyway. They had their own selection of games, and it was decided that Mark is the guy who does games, and so I was going to be playing games with them. So we played Flowerfall by Carl Chudik and Asmati Games. Flowerfall is the area majority game where you're just dropping cards. It's like a dexterity game. I had some misgivings about this, primarily because one of the things that I've internalized about the difficulties of playing with children is that there's the rules load, which is one issue, right? But a more pressing issue is how well are they able to internalize formalisms? Because games exist and survive on formalisms. I don't mean formalisms like scoring conventions or what have you. I'm talking about the basic stuff like play proceeds clockwise, or you're not allowed to do X, Y, or Z, or keep your card secret and don't let anyone see it. You know, these basic fundamental things that children often have a great deal of difficulty with. No judgment. I'm just saying that's something that kids find difficult. In the case of Flowerfall, what you're supposed to do... Flowerfall is a great game, by the way. A true story. The time distance between discussion of the concept and first working prototype was 12 hours. And the first working prototype, which I played with my friend Chris, who published the game, full disclosure, was more or less the same as the final version. I quite enjoy Flowerfall. It's a weird take on dexterity games, just being able to drop cards so they can land properly. So then the question is, drop from what height? Well, you're supposed to extend your arm out straight from your shoulder. This is something that children find very difficult. Not extending their arm out, but just... it's fascinating how the error always seems to be their hand going lower and lower and lower. The particular trick that these boys would do was they kind of understood that they were supposed to have their arm out from shoulder length, but then a motion would begin. The motion would end with them dropping the card, and the motion would begin with their hand at their shoulder level, but there would be a sort of downward swoop in the process. Anyway, I'm not complaining too much. I'm just observing that these are some of the challenges you have when playing games with small children in many cases, especially ones that find conventions difficult to follow. Flowerfall is a great game. I thoroughly enjoy it. We then follow that up with Micro Macro Crime City All In, and indeed it is helpful to have the Crime City versions that have the age appropriateness of the cases involved, and All In has them. All of them except the original Crime City have them. And so we went through a couple of cases. We were doing cases that I'd done before so I could, you know, sort of nudge them along in case they weren't able to connect the necessary tissue. And that was great. They were clambering all over the map and pointing out weird little vignettes that were unrelated to the existing case and nonetheless find them interesting. So they were very engrossed by Micro Macro and indeed asked for more cases thereupon. But the big success, the towering achievement of Mark Plays Games with Children, was I saw that they had Win, Loser, Banana by Asmati Games. Again, also published by my friend and in this case also designed by Chris Cheslick of Asmati Games. But if you have a copy of Win, Loser, Banana, or indeed if you have the chits of Win, Loser, Banana from your copy of Fealty, designed by Eric Royce, another personal friend, I'm not name-dropping, I'm just disclosing, then you can play the simplest social deduction game ever designed, Who's the Banana? Are you familiar with Who's the Banana, Walker?
You have talked about it before, but yeah. I'd like to give it a try.
So Who's the Banana is very simple. You can play, in my experience, you can play with three or four players. More than that starts to go down. In the three-player version, you take a copy of Win, Loser, Banana, you deal out the cards. The person who's won has won and now needs to find the banana. And it is the job of the people who are dealt lose and banana to convince the winner that they are the banana. You win if you get chosen, and you also win as the winner if you correctly identify the banana. This was a big hit. Telling some six-year-olds that they needed to convince someone that they were a banana went about as several of the ways that you might have expected. And so we played round after round of Who's the Banana. I managed to deceive some children. I was a little bit worried, actually. Frankly, this is a more broader ethical concern because I don't want to do that thing that a lot of people do, which is judge other people's parenting decisions or engage in the process of undermining parental authority. These are things that I don't want to do. And I realized about halfway through our second round of Who's the Banana, it's like, am I introducing the concept of recreational lying to this household? Am I the vector through which socially acceptable mendacity has been delivered under this family? And I was very fortunate. I was very relieved when they said, yeah, we understand. We're allowed to lie here. It's just like the game Cheat. And then it's like, oh, the parents taught them the game Cheat. Okay, so they understand the difference between the bad kind of lying and the accepted kind of lying in the context of the game. Fine. So Who's the Banana? Highly recommended. It is basically social deduction pared down to its simplicity. I would infinitely rather play Who's the Banana than Blood on the Clock Tower, that's for sure. So that's my roundup of playing with children, Flower Fall, Micro Macro, Crime City All In, and Who's the Banana.
Speaking of games for children, and something they need to do is keep their attention, right?
100%.
A game that does that is something we just played today. It's called Dodo. And I picked this up because I'm playing
games. That's not a nice thing to call children, Walker.
I know, I'm sorry.
They're just underdeveloped.
I've been playing games with 9 and 11-year-olds, and I saw this, and I thought they would love it. So I picked it up. So you build this great stone tower.
It's not stone, Walker. It's plastic and cardboard.
Oh, my goodness. And you put the dodo, a dodo standee sits on top, and then you take this magical thing that is a ball that moves on its own.
So it's about 2 to 3 inches diameter. So it's pretty big. And there's some weird mechanism on the inside. You shake it up like crazy. And then it kind of rolls by itself, but at a very slow pace. That's the only way I know
also,
how to describe it.
And it also like defies gravity in a way.
Yeah.
Because as it launches out of the top of this tower.
I don't know if launch is the right word.
Sorry, it meanders out of the top of this tower and then hits the first ramp, which is not at a flat level. It's at
quite, it's like 10
quite
degrees
an angle.
Or so, yeah.
And it doesn't slide or roll. No, it just sort of starts jiggling its way down.
It's really strange.
And while,
honestly, when you put it on like, you know, a 5 to 10 degree surface, it looks like there's something moving inside the ball. That's the pace and the sort of general canter of how it moves. It's very striking.
So this is a real time game. So that's what's going to keep their attention. They're going to look up and see this ball slowly going towards the edge of this cliff. And so what you're doing is you're rolling the die, and then there's this mass of chits, and you have to flip up a chit that matches the die face that you've rolled. And if it doesn't, you put it down and the next person rolls. And if you get it right, you get to put it on the set of ramps that are on the side. And if you fill up the ramp, then you get to place the ramp on the tower. So the ball has somewhere to go to next. And so you're racing, trying to get all the ramps on. And then once you've got all the ramps on, there's this, you know, 6-token space where the raft needs to go that's going to catch the egg at the end. So you have to fill that up with guesses and then you win. Nice and easy. Wonderful little game. Dodo.
I was disappointed by the execution of the physical gimmick on a couple of occasions. You assert that this is because your table isn't perfectly level.
It got caught
on a couple of the corners. The ball did. So it stopped, and we had to give it a little nudge so that it continued on its little journey.
I feel that that's the reason. That's one of the sort of, it does have a little troubleshooting sheet in the box. Like if something's going on, and the main cause, they say, is that your table's not level.
I can believe that.
And setting up the game, it actually says, you know, level, make sure your table's level. I don't know how you'd fix that. But
yeah, but the standards for levelness in this context, like we play lots of games where rolling is an issue or where circular tokens would roll off the edge of the board, whether it's part of a dexterity game or not. And your table is, for all layman's purposes, perfectly level. So the fact that any minor discrepancies in the table can cause the game to cease to function properly means that you need it to be super level for it to work. Now, I'm exaggerating the extent to which this was a burden. We noticed that it stopped and we gave it a tiny nudge. It wasn't a big deal. But it did, however, kind of break the magic that was this very deliberate paced thing rolling down. And there were these moments of little drama because as it jumps from the platforms that you're building, they don't make one continuous ramp. There are these, the ball tumbles the dodo egg, supposedly. tumbles a centimeter or two from one ramp to another. And when it does that, it goes like halfway down the next ramp, and it makes you feel like you're under time pressure even if you're not. So that's well done. I think it's a cool physical gimmick that works well with the game. I wish it worked perfectly, and it's got a cute little memory element. Yeah, I'd happily play this with kids as well. And we enjoyed it as adults. So this is Dodo, designed by Frank Babenroth and Marco Tubner, published by Cosmos in 2020.
Glad I got it. It's very neat.
It is very cool. Showed Walker and the Boys Life in Reterra. This is the second time I'm playing it. This is the Target exclusive, designed by Ken Gruhl and Eric Lang, published by Hasbro. And it is a very simple tiling game with a variety of different building effects. This time we played with Building Set 2. Previously I played with Building Set 1, as you might imagine. Although I did modify a couple of the buildings during setup due to my own disappointments. I saw the 5 buildings that we were supposed to set up, and contra my observation last time playing, there was absolutely no building that made any reference to any other player at the table. I don't demand direct confrontation. It's just one of the things that I liked about Life in Reterra the first time is that there were a number of different tiles that cared about your standing with respect to your neighbors. And so I flipped over the restaurant in particular so that the restaurant was now worth 2 points or 4 points per restaurant if you had more restaurants than either of your neighbors. And I did the same thing with another building, just so it was slightly more than no player interaction whatsoever. Anyway, what did you think, Walker?
It was a great tile layer game, much like a lot of the stuff that's come out lately. I don't think it broke any big barriers. You know, you place tiles, and depending on where you put the stuff, it's going to get you points. I know you can use that as any game, but you know what?
That could have been Life in Reterra or Tigris and Euphrates, but there's a tremendous difference between the two.
I mean, like a Cascadia or a Calico, depending on how you place your tiles, right, you're going to score more or less points.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I was a little disappointed by the building powers this time. They were interestingly different from the first set, but as I say, I would have liked there to be slightly more competition or interaction encouraged by the building set. So I think next time, if I'm going to play again, I will look at building set number 3, and I'll look at both sides of the cards and really decide what way to play. I might even take a look at some of the bespoke combinations that they recommend at the back of the rule book. So my opinion has gone down a little bit from my previous time. I thought, you know, it was slightly above average as far as the hordes of tile layers that are very approachable recently are. And now I just think it's probably just more or less in the meaty part of the pack. But we'll see. The jury is, to a certain extent, still out.
And how they made it similar to King Domino was odd as well. Because and I like the limitations where you're limited to like the certain grid.
Yes.
And then the terrain types were very similar to King Domino as
that
well.
That is true. That's a good point. Yeah. No, I kind of appreciate the fact that you're limited to the 4x4.
Yeah, no, that's what I mean. That's the parts I liked about
it. Yeah. The contours of how it influences how you're going to build out. You know, you're completely wide open at the beginning. You feel like you can go anywhere, and then quickly the limitations start setting in. And you realize you should have been a little bit more conscious, and yeah, I approve of it. That is Life in Reterra by Ken Gruhl and Eric Lang.
So the new hotness, Windmill Valley, I played it a few times this week. This is designed by Danny Garcia, the same designer as Barcelona, and put out by Board and Dice. And it feels a little bit like Crusaders because you have this dial that you're turning, but unlike Crusaders, you have 2 interlocking dials like Praga Kaput Rigny, and they're different sizes as well, so the 2 actions will never quite line up. And you're constantly buying upgrade tiles, and they slot into the 2 different wheels, and so as you turn them, different ones will line up, and sometimes you can choose which one to do, and sometimes it's a bonus tile, so you get to do both actions, which is kind of interesting as well. So what you do is you decide how far you want to turn your windmill. There are 2 windmills. Of course, windmills often interlocked, right? You get them close together. Anyway, it's probably the gears inside the windmill.
Okay.
All right.
Well, you have 1 set of gears for 2 windmills. Is that the idea?
Supposedly.
Sure. Then, I'm no engineer, but that tracks.
And then, so you decide how far you want to turn it, and then there's sort of a payment. If you wanted to, you can turn up to 4 times by moving the water flow faster and then maybe spending some tools. And then depending if you increase the water level, then it's going to increase the overall water level, which is going to make another action better or worse for other people. Unfortunately, that part of the game never flushed out in the 3 games that I played because a lot of times people were just moving it 1, because you move it down all the way, it goes, you know, from 1 to 3 times you want to turn it. And so you can bring it all the way down for nothing, or you can bring it up, you know, for money, which is sometimes hard to get. So normally people just normally bring it down, and therefore the water level will never increase. So that never washed out. And it's a big section of the board. Quarter of the board is for that. Another huge section of the board is simply to put out windmills. And that's all you're doing. You're putting windmills out on this board, and you get some of the benefits that are around the windmill. It takes up the huge part of the table.
Okay.
And I played it solo and then played two multiplayer games, and I do enjoy it. It's very combo-y, like Barcelona. It's like you're getting more tiles that are going to give you more actions, which will let you plant tulips. And as you put tulips in your garden, it triggers more actions, which you do those as well, which might trigger even more actions. And so eventually your turns get a little bit long. Four players, a little bit draggy, but still enjoyed every playing of it. And the solo game went very well as well. The AI is just turn a card. They do their action, which is normally just, you know, pile the stuff they get into a pile, and it's going to score points at the end of the game. And then you get to do what you want to do, which is, you know, make your dials cooler, put out windmills, grow your little tulips. You want to put them in particular rows and columns because it's going to get you more points
You got to have tulips with the windmills, otherwise it's not there.
It's true. And then there's this
stereotypical as it could be.
Multi-use cards. Multi-use cards are always nice.
It's true.
So you have these multi-use cards that either slide into the top of your board, which is going to get you bonuses for all the different actions that you can do, or they slide into the bottom, which is endgame scoring stuff. Hopefully we'll get a chance to show it to you. That is Windmill Valley by Board and Dice.
Played another game of Raw. Realized to my shock and horror that Louis had never played Raw.
Oh my God.
And so we played Raw with Louis. And it was a very strange game of Raw. Now, a great thing about Raw is that the economy is going to shake out slightly differently every time. This is true of many good auction games. And it's also the case that different tiles coming out at different times are going to make Raw feel differently. What happened was, though, we had a very quick Epic 1. Epic 1 was super, super quick. In point of fact, Louis did not score any points during Epic 1. He didn't get anything. He got a couple of monuments, a couple of Niles that didn't flood, so really it was a null round. So he lost 2 points for not having any pharaohs, he lost 5 points for not having any civilizations, because the raw tiles just came out really quickly. Now, I had gone out of the round a couple of raw tiles before the end, so I felt great about the fact that this round went very, very quickly. And then round two was very long. No, not unduly long, I just mean in comparison to a normal Epic of Raw, it was unusually long. And so one of the key things about learning how to play Raw well, more on that later when we talk about game mastery actually, is being able to manage the tempo of a given round and knowing when to wait and when to jump on opportunities that might not be perfect. It's hard to do that when the bag is messing with you. The Raw tiles are coming out either too quickly or too slowly. I went in to Epic 3. I don't know that I've ever seen anyone do this before. I had certainly never done it before. I went into Epic 3 with the following three sun tiles. I'll tell you which my first two were and see if you can guess what the last one was. I had the one. I had the two. Guess what my last one was.
Ooh, three.
It was the three. Now,
big spender.
I am going to be the first person to tell you that having a one or a two in Raw is great. You can call an auction every time. Anything you get will be worth it. The problem is when all you have are the one, two, and three, that's when things are a little bit harder because then you know you're never going to get anything that anyone really wants. And by really wants, I mean is willing to spend their worst tile on. So naturally, I didn't get a civilization in the last round. I didn't get much of anything in the last round. It was only on the strength of round two that I did very well. And just as a redemption story, Louis, despite not having done anything of note in the first round, ended up tying for first place. So it was a remarkable rally. So strange. Another thing that happened in round one was that 8 of the 12 floods came out. And so...
8?
Yes. So I was sitting there and I had all these Niles. I had about 7 or 8 Nile tiles, largely by accident. I hadn't sought them out. It was a minor miracle that I got them to flood in Epic 2. I certainly knew they weren't going to flood in Epic 3, what with there being so few floods left and my having terrible spending capacity. It was just a strange game. Even strange games of Raw are brilliant, and I really like how the fundamental economy is going to work perfectly fine regardless of how wild things get. Nothing's going to break. Nothing's going to swing wildly out of control. You just have to know when to pick your spots and know when to press the advantage and take a risk. Raw, Greatest auction game ever made, greatest press your luck game ever made.
So I had a couple old friends come over, and we got to show Mark River of Gold. This is designed by Keith Pegott and put out by Office Dog. And every turn you've rolled a die, so you know the die you've rolled, and it's going to give you a certain section of the map or a certain number. The section of the map is going to be where you get to build a building or the type of delivery you can make, and the die numbers is going to tell you how far you're going to move your boat, and you have to pick one of those things. And throughout the game, unfortunately, it sort of comes down to the thing I'm just getting tired of this year is get stuff, spend stuff, then get more stuff so you can spend more stuff so you can get more stuff. So you're spending these resources to build buildings, spending the resources to do deliveries, upgrading your boat, getting different scoring conditions going. Overall, I don't think it was overly offensive. It was kind of enjoyable to play. There's some things you get to modify your die, so it felt as though you're locked into what that die was, but you have this other sort of currency that you can spend to turn it, so you can modify it at key moments of the game when you need a specific number or a specific symbol. I would play River of Gold again. It's also on Board Game Arena. Mark, what did you think of River of Gold?
It was okay. But I think ultimately the influence of randomness is just too potent for my tastes. It is true that there is a currency that exists exclusively to modify the result of the die, and it is the currency that is the most difficult to get. If you're short on money, there are money spots all over the board. If you're short on resources, there are resource spots all over the board. By and large, the way that you improve your ability to get this other currency, it's called favor. The way you get better favor is in part by deploying cards. But the cards can only be deployed when your die matches what's on the card. You've got a two-card hand, and you're rolling a d6. So if you're sitting there, and you've got a couple of cards, and they both say two, and you're reliably rolling four, you're reliably rolling five, or what have you, and you are out of favor, or you're low on favor, well then, guess what? You just keep waiting until you roll the result you want. And given how consequential card play is generally in River of Gold, I think your hand size should have been way higher. I think your ability to cycle cards should have been way higher. So much is determined, ultimately, by what the die tells you you get to do on a given round. And if it's the case that you're laboriously gathering these resources to be able to play this card so as to give you more flexibility going forward or just for the point scoring opportunities, not being able to do so turn after turn merely by virtue of what the die is telling you is not great. And so I felt often that was the primary limitation on what it is that I could do on a given turn. If I was short on money and I couldn't build the building that I wanted to build because I needed to go get more cash, yeah, sure, fine, whatever. I'll figure out the different ways for me to get money. I'm willing to go do that. Same thing with resources. But when I've got the money I need and I need to build a building, or I've got the resources I need and I want to play the card and I just can't because I'm rolling the wrong number, that's when my enthusiasm starts to wane. And I didn't think it was particularly stellar outside that context to begin with. And so for me, it's a pass.
On top of that randomness, there are sort of game goals, which will be like build one of each type of building or build one of each time of the, or deliver one type of each of these different types of people.
Yes, the latter of which is dependent on your two-card hand and the former of which is dependent on a very small building display.
Yes, so I have one of each, but is it randomly going to come up that I need? Someone else going to need that building and build it before me?
Yeah.
Or, you know, like you said, it's impossible to get the card. So is it going to cycle to just happen to be the ones that I need?
I got 7 points in a relatively low scoring game. I don't think anybody cracked 60 by virtue of the fact that there was a single type of building in the display that I needed. And I built it, and we never saw that type of building enter the display ever again over the course of the game. Had I missed out on doing that at the wrong time, or if someone else had gotten there first, that would have just been the supply telling who gets the 7 points. So there's nothing particularly offensive about River of Gold. It's just there's nothing particularly gripping either. And so then when you have this additional friction of strange luck influence, I think that makes it a reason to look it over. I'm also not a huge fan. I realize it's the setting of Rokugan, and Rokugan means a lot for some people, I'm sure. But would it have been the end of the world to just make it historically themed and actually have it take place in Japan rather than some sort of weirdly mythologized for no particular reason Japan? I don't know. It seemed like another missed opportunity.
River of Gold.
River of Gold by Keith Pigott, published by Office Dog, which is a great publisher name, I gotta say.
You and I also got to play Spectral. I talked about Spectral last week. It is sort of like a deduction game where there's this, 4x4 grid, and you're trying to figure out where the treasures are and where the curses are by putting explorers out and secretly looking at the cards and using your little notebook to, you know, clue style, figure out where everything is. And once you know where a couple of the cards are, you can sort of deduce what the other cards are and what implications they have. And then get your explorers out to where the treasure is and where curses aren't. And then try to end the game to your advantage.
Yeah, the tempo considerations are potentially very interesting, especially insofar as it scales with a number of players, but we played with four, and leftover explorers, leftover tokens for influence are with 2 points each, which is non-trivial. That can be a substantial proportion of your final game score. It was for me anyway, but I didn't do very well, so there's that. It is the kind of thing where the information network is necessarily going to be incomplete, and you are expected to fill in the gaps by observing what other people are doing and trying to make back inferences about what they know and what is causing them to do what they're doing. I was just at the level on, now granted it's one play, but it's also not really my kind of game, of recognizing the contours of what that kind of evaluation would look like and deciding I didn't want to do it. It was because, to be clear, I don't like deduction games. It's not a kind of game that I enjoy. And it triggers all my dislike of specific kind of puzzles, generally speaking. And it also gives me flashbacks for studying for standardized tests about people wearing sweaters of various colors and where they're sitting and et cetera, or whatever you want to say. I did do well on the LSAT, though, but setting all that aside. And I would look at my incomplete map of information, and it's like, okay, so I know what these two cards are, so therefore I know that these other two cards are from the set of this two cards. If A is the case, then Y and Z would be the case. If B is the case, well, then W and X are the case. I don't feel like working out this tree. seriously, that was literally what was happening. I could see it was interesting how such a light rule set and a quick play time could get you to those kinds of questions. Those are just not the kind of questions I enjoy answering.
I was kind of the opposite. I was, because it was my second game, so I could, you know, figure out a little bit more. I knew that at this one intersection, there were treasures on both sides. And so I wanted to dump a bunch of explorers there. But first, I needed to know that there was no curses.
Right.
So I just went through my head. It's like,
you did the back formation of figuring
out. Where could it be? It's like, well, if it's a, you know, a double diagonal, then it would be here.
Yep.
And I know that that isn't that. And if it was, you know, the clockwise, then all I need to do is figure out what this one card says. Then I know I can dump a bunch of guys there and be in contention for both these treasures. I am very much enjoying it. It's a review copy, before I forget to say, from Bitewind Games.
Designed by Ryan Courtney.
And I'm looking forward to more plays, because there's a bunch of little sort of side modules where you get to add like funky cards that do all sorts of weird stuff.
Yeah, I'd be interested to hear what somebody who really likes the old school complete all the nodes in your spreadsheet deduction games like Sleuth would think. Because I wonder if because even with operating on making inferences from other players' actions, even with engaging in the kind of elimination, the process of elimination you're talking about, you're still going to have to operate on uncertain information. And so I wonder if it would rub people the wrong way who really like the, who want the deduction to be without any sort of, it's not random per se, it's unknown at the time of. And so it is still possible in some cases for you to have to make either the 50-50 gamble or sometimes to possibly even be surprised as to where a curse is, especially if you start getting into the more elaborate card sets. I don't know.
Spectral.
Interesting design, not for me. I finally got to show Walker Bargain Hunter. I was actually shocked that I hadn't played Bargain Hunter with you before. Bargain Hunter is probably my favorite trick-taking game this side of Vashticht, which I still haven't played in a long, long time. It's done by Uwe Rosenberg. This is back when Uwe Rosenberg was only known as that guy who did Bonanza, and before he became Uwe Rosenberg. It's a complicated story, if you can get the implicature involved here. And long story short, it has two clever elements. One of them is you only score points for one particular value of card. Everything else becomes junk, but there's a process by which you can convert your junk into points. And so what you were previously avoiding, say you weren't looking for eights, but you get stuck with a whole bunch of eights, you might say, oh, okay, well, I guess I'll start going for eights now. Nobody can stop me. And the other cool thing is that when you play offsuit, you have the opportunity of declaring something to be trump. If someone leads red, you have to follow red if you can. But if you can't, you play yellow or green or what have you. You have the opportunity to stipulate that for that trick, that card is trump. Given that most cards you're not going to want to win, that gives you a lot of control about what kind of trick you do and do not get. And those are the features that I really find make Bargain Hunter appealing. What did you think, Walker?
Well, the other thing is that a lot of the suits have two numbers. And so when you play the same number on, like, a purple two on a purple two, you can say whether it's higher or lower. And that is wonderful as well.
It's true.
As you were talking about it, I realized the feeling I had when I was playing it. It sort of takes cooperative crew and turns it into a competitive game. Whereas you can sort of see the missions that they're on, because the cards that they're looking for are face up. So it's like they're looking for twos. And so you're looking at your hand. It's like, how and when can I play these twos
so that
in order for them not to get it? And so I thought that part was fantastic. Everything about it was great.
Yeah, Bargain Hunter is wonderful. It's been out of print for a very, very long time. Trick Takers are having a moment, but I think that Bargain Hunter wouldn't necessarily fit into the cutting-edge zeitgeist of trick-taking games. You know, when I think of the trick-taking games of right now, I'm thinking primarily of two-player games, co-op or not, and the ones that are really weird, like really kind of bizarre, like Ghosts of Christmas. Even things like Marshmallow Test is just weird enough to kind of fit in that bucket. Bargain Hunter, I don't know, would fit in that, but then again, I could be wrong. I'm really bad at anticipating what people are going to like and what people aren't going to like, but I do think it deserves to be reprinted. It's just a deck of cards. You could probably proxy it without too much difficulty, and it's been a perennial favorite of mine. It's one of those...
Probably two decks of cards. Because a lot of them have two.
Not with a single deck of cards, because there's 12 cards. There's six suits, two versions of each, so there's 12 cards per number. So you'd need three decks at least, and then start to mark them up like crazy.
Yeah.
But as it is, you might have another hobbyist game that has a weird deck of cards that you can proxy. That's all I'm getting at.
The other interesting part is the three you have to speculate. Because, you know, you have,
yep.
At the beginning of the game, you decide, okay, I'm going to go for fives. It doesn't matter what color they are. You're just trying to collect fives in whatever way you can. And then you have, you know, you obviously know that's not going to last forever. You know, either people are going to stop letting you get them, or there's just not that many fives to get. And so you have to know or look what's in your junk pile and sort of try to start winning cards and, you know, seed your junk pile with like a number that you want to start next.
Yeah, there's this tipping point. You know, you get that five, you're looking for fives, someone starts feeding you sevens. The first couple sevens are a burden, but then you get three, four sevens in that pile. Ooh, that's an opportunity.
Yeah, exactly.
And then, just going past what Walker's observation about it feeling a little bit like a competitive version of the crew, then people start noticing this. Like, oh, wait, why did they decide to win that trick? Oh, they're going for sevens now on top of the fives that they're openly declaring. Okay, add that to the roster.
Yeah, I love it. Really?
Yeah, Bargain Hunter's great. There was an attempt on the part of myself, Woogie, and Josephus to come up with a joke version of a fake bad sitcom called No Trumps for You. The theme song went, and I'm quoting the lyrics here, trumpety, trump, trump, trumpety, trump, trump. We came up with this idea in the early 2000s.
I was going to say, wasn't that the theme of the election?
Yeah, no, this idea has aged poorly.
Gotcha.
And so we've had to scrap it and mothball it. I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, I was going to be cast as the wacky neighbor, a Kramer type. No, that was Josephus. Josephus was going to be the wacky neighbor next door type. I don't remember what my role was in this fake sitcom. Anyway, that's Bargain Hunter by Uwe Rosenberg.
We also got Faith Forge, Chronicles of Khan, Back to the Table. This is a app-driven, dungeon-crawling type game that has a very interesting sort of puzzly map element to it as well. This is designed by Goran Klea and put out by Mighty Boards. This was an odd session, I guess you could say. We were all, it's like, you have really cool toys, but we're not going to let you use all of those toys this time. We're gonna modify how you use those toys.
Yeah. I respect the desire to mix things up, so I'm willing to give them a pass. It's not how I would have done, and it's not a choice that I particularly appreciated, but nonetheless, in the vein of, well, we can't just let every combat encounter feel like every other combat encounter. Let's mix things up a bit. So I'm willing to give them the benefit of the doubt on that. There were, however, two other things in this session of Fate Forge.
Oh, but it wasn't just this session. This session.
Okay. Two elements of this session of Fate Forge that was leaning into elements of Fate Forge that I do not appreciate. One of them is the relentless proper nouns. Endless proper nouns. Look, I know it's a pre-existing fantasy setting. I know there's a role-playing game. I know it's a whole thing. But come on, guys. You can.
It doesn't have to be for every single person we meet.
Or piece of material. Like, you can use words like metal or north. These are words you can use rather than in every sentence asking me to learn how to pronounce a new set of consonant and vowel clusters with weird and non-standard use of accents. And there's no pronunciation guide anywhere.
Or this, out of town. Or not yeah, from around here.
Yeah, all of these would have worked. Honestly, I respect the fact that look, I'm willing to give them, again, the benefit of the doubt and assume that it's out of some degree of enthusiasm for the setting. But it doesn't give me enthusiasm for the setting. It honestly rubs me the wrong way. I find it tiresome.
Yep, it's this odd person's name from an odd person district wearing this weird garb that had to be named that is also from a different area. Oh, man. And that's not just what that's over and
every
over
every paragraph
again.
Every over and over in the because we only normally when we play Fate Forge we play several combat encounters back to back. This time. I still have a great deal of enthusiasm for Fate Forge. It's the only campaign we're doing. That should tell you something. Of the dozens of promising or potentially viable campaign systems that exist, this is the one we're sticking with. This is the one we went back to. Not even a stroke could keep Michael Walker away from Fate Forge, right?
That's right.
But I said, look, we've only done one combat encounter. I think we need to call it a day. So that, because if there's like two or three more proper nouns that I'm going to have to say reading from this app screen, I may never want to come back to this game again. I don't want that to happen. So I'm serious. That I was just getting a little frustrated. The other thing that Fate Forge did for the first time was it introduced my favorite element from Dungeon Crawls, stun mechanics. No, stop. Don't do it. Don't. No more. Let me have a full turn.
It's true.
Still love the game. Didn't like that session, though.
That was Fate Forge, Chronicles of Khan. Like I said earlier, I played a few games of Heat Pedal to the Metal, designed by
Asger Harding Granerud and Daniel Skjold Peterson.
And put out by Days of Wonder. I will stick to what I said earlier without even playing it and just reading the rule book. And the fact that the cars don't block each other, I still enjoyed it. There's this interesting mechanic, guess what, Mark? It's called Heat, because you have to manage your heat. Because you need these heat cards to do a bunch of different things. And when you use them, they go into your deck. And then you have to cycle them back into your hand. And then use abilities to get them back onto your board where you can use them to use special abilities. So all of these things are kind of interesting. And managing your hand, because you want to have big numbers when you go down the straightaways. And you need to hit the corners just right, because there's speed on the corners. Just like in Formula Day. And if your total speed is higher, then that causes you to lose heat. Anyway, I enjoyed the games of it that I had. There's tons of different modules that you can add that will let you sort of draft funky cards into your deck at the beginning and weather and all sorts of other stuff that I'm sure I'm going to enjoy when I try them out. I'm going to play more on Board Game Arena, but other than that, I don't think I'm, you know, earning to play it in real life.
Yeah, it's weird. Heat has really struck a chord with, I think, a large number of people. And I like you, am mostly unmoved. And I don't even object to the no blocking part. I mean, I respect the fact that for you, if you're going to do a car racing game, blocking needs to be an essential part of the game. I'm not there with you, but I understand. Heat, for me, is just it's okay. I don't understand the burning enthusiasm. You see what I did there? That was heat burning.
Heat
and burning, yeah.
That was quite a connection you made
Thank
there.
You. Yeah, thank you. I'm on fire today.
Whoa.
So those are the games we played last week. Now a brief break while we pay some bills.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
Save big money on your next outdoor project at Menards. Menards has the best in-stock selection of AC2 pressure-treated lumber. Our huge inventory of decking, fencing, lumber, and timbers are all easy to load in our drive-thru lumber yard. Plus, you can get free estimates fast with our fence and deck design programs in-store or online at Menards.com. Don't forget to check out our weekly flyer for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
And we're back, and on to the news and why it doesn't matter.
Only one piece of news from me. We thought the feeling behind Turing Machine was very interesting.
Turing Machine.
Turing Machine. To take you on a tour?
No, it's...
I know. And so the same people are bringing out a game called Chronologic, and they're bringing out three sort of separate games, and they're sort of a deduction game using the same... Seems like the same kind of system, a little slightly different, and they're happening like different time eras. So the first one is Paris 1920, then we have Babylon 2500 coming out, and Cusco 1450. So all these sort of mystery, murder-type deduction games coming out from the same designers.
Is this Babylon 2500 CE or 2500 BCE?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, it's not in the future.
Okay, then it'd be 2500 BCE.
Okay.
That is the news and why it doesn't matter. All of it. And now on to our topic for this week, which is game mastery. So, Walker, what did you have in mind in this topic of game mastery?
Well, I'm wondering if we're missing out from an experience, Mark, because we're jumping from game to game instead of focusing on one particular sort of experience. And I'm
like
wondering,
those space cats and peace turtles?
Just so.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if we're missing out on something by jumping around so much like we do. It's like this constant question of, you know, are we missing out on a certain type of experience by playing the same game over and over again?
Well, I think the answer is unquestionably. I mean, obviously it would be very different
yes.
if we were to be hobbyists that way. The point is, what are we gaining and what are we losing?
Yes.
And I definitely think that it is good to emphasize the extent to which you and I, very nobly, in an almost saint-like heroic way, have sacrificed ourselves on the altar of content for the sake of our dear listeners.
It's the level of selflessness, Mark, that really sometimes gets to me.
Yeah. I'm moved by my own sense of superiority.
I find it hard to speak about it sometimes.
I'm getting a little verklempt at how virtuous we are, frankly. So, we were, and again, it's worth emphasizing again, even before we signed ourselves up for the kind of content and for the kind of show that we are making, we were already inclined towards a certain degree of churn.
Correct.
There are nonetheless, though, even in our hyper-churn lifestyles, the perennial favorites to which we return. Not necessarily at the same rate at which we would otherwise. Okay,
But the reasons why we return, are the reasons because we want to get better at the game, or are the reasons because...
Well, that's the thing,
we
right.
very much just enjoy playing that game.
Okay, let me ask you a question. Let me handle this somewhat biographically, right? Back when you were playing 40K all the time, I think I know the answer to this question. Because correct me if I'm wrong, 40K, your 40K period, if you would, like your blue period, was perhaps your most protracted period of mostly playing the same thing over and over. Maybe Axis and Allies trumps it. But during those periods when you were playing the same thing, almost exclusively, what was your attitude towards skills acquisition during those periods?
Zero. That's why I always say that when the tournament scene came in and where victory became essential and or the thing that people were going for, it became quickly unfun for me.
Yeah.
And almost within a week was done.
Yeah.
100%.
That's exactly it. Like, based on your stories about how you played 40K with like weird restrictions and bizarre scenarios just to see weird things happen on the table, which I can completely respect. That's completely at odds with, well, not completely. It is somewhat in tension with the desire to apply yourself to get skills mastery at a particular game. I personally, in my gaming experience, think that I'm pretty good at two games. There are two games that I would point to that I think I'm pretty good at. One of them is Raw, and one of them is Infinity. And I stopped playing Infinity, more or less for similar reasons than you did. Infinity is, Roby Jenkins talks about this all the time in the context of tabletop miniatures games. Either you have a tournament scene or you don't. And the moment you do, a lot of things start to change. Attitudes towards rule sets, attitude towards play, attitude towards scenario design, a whole bunch of things. He doesn't want to touch that with a 10-foot pole. I really like everything about Infinity, except the part where, well, there are two things that I don't like about Infinity and why I stopped playing. One of them is that if there's a difference in skill of the two players at the game, then the person who's losing is not going to have a good time. They're just not really going to be. It's like X-Wing. It's like different reasons, but slightly similar to X-Wing. When the player who's playing well just denies the opponent the ability to do anything. It's like, I've got my fire lanes down. I've completely depleted your order pool. Congratulations, here's your useless turn. Oh, it's my turn again. I'm going to murder you some more. And that's just not fun for me in either position. And the other problem was, and this is the big issue, and this is the biggest reason why I stopped playing Infinity, is I realized I started to care about who won. Obviously, I'm not going to pretend like I'm completely indifferent towards winning, but I really started to care. And I remember very distinctly, I was playing a game. I took a shot that my odds of hitting were really, really good, and I missed. And I felt like my self-regard was somehow implicated when those D20s were staring back at me with the results that were slightly statistically aberrant and the ones I didn't want. And I looked at it as I gotta stop doing this. I just, like, this was not a way to live. And I guess what I'm saying is I've had glimpses at skill acquisition in games. I want nothing to do with it. Very much like you. Have you read strategy, like any of the strategy fora on Board Game Geek? For various games that we play?
Only for Gaia Project. And that was just due to research on people talking about that some factions were overpowered than others. And so I was just sort of reading why they thought that.
Yeah. It's like glimpsing into a different hobby.
Yes.
I remember very distinctly, this was a while ago, I almost never go into strategy guides because there's a certain joy of discovery, and there's a certain joy of, this is going to sound like an exaggeration, a certain joy of self-expression in playing games, of doing the thing you want to try to do for whatever reason, rather than the thing you read turns out to be effective. And that's, if you don't want to play that way, that's fine. I'm not judging. I'm really not.
That's what I was going to interject with. This is how we feel.
Yeah. And I remember reading, I don't even remember why I went there, a strategy guide about scythe openings. Talked about this on the show before, about how the number of turns it takes to get to the factory. If you're going as quickly as possible, how long does it take to get to the factory? And they just laid out, here's your first 17 turns of the game. I'm like, that's not how I want to play games. That's why I stopped playing chess in high school.
I have to admit that in early days, like when I said, remember we like took a week off school to play Axe and Allies.
Yeah.
It did get to that point. You know, there were certain openings that you needed to do. And if you didn't, then there was anger. You know, you're ruining the game for us. You know, you're allowing Germany to get in. You needed to, you know, cut them off
there.
So
the Puerto Rico problem showed up in Axis and Allies.
Oh, for sure.
And how was your response
to
that?
We were in the zone, though. Like, and then, you know, later games, that never even came in. It was like just in that week of heavy competition.
And you were swept up in it. You were in there. Oh, wow. For sure. Fascinating.
I just want to say a couple things that feed into exactly what you're saying.
Is
the benefit of game mastery, is it the journey to get there or is it the destination, right?
Yeah.
Is it the finding the different avenues of mastery? And once you get there, do the games just become procedural after that, right? Once you've sort of figured out the winning strategy. And of course, all games will be different because X will take this tile before you get it or Y. But, you know, in general, will the game just be like, I know what it takes to get the higher score. And so now I do this, then I do that, then I do this. And I'm not sure. So is that fun for some people or I don't know.
For some people, it clearly is. And they very much enjoy it. Like there are some people who've played the same, what I would consider. Sometimes I play a game and I think it's too computational, even for a couple of plays. And there are some people who play that game hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times. Right. And they find pleasure in that process. That's not how I approach hobbyist gaming. Not even for the first couple of plays. And so the games that I keep going back to, like, for example, Raw and Tigers and Euphrates, it's just the board state, or in the case of Raw, the economy, is so variable. It's about adapting to the vicissitudes and the pressures erected by the other players at the table and reacting to that. That's And again, different people approach hobby gaming in different ways. And those are the kind of games that, for me, are the kind of games where I'm willing to play enough so that I accidentally acquire some degree of proficiency, right? I do not do hobby gaming for self-improvement. This does not reflect well on me. In point of fact, it reflects poorly on me. No, I mean this very sincerely. Like, I know you don't have a... this probably isn't a feature of a lot of your social experience or a lot of social experience of many of our listeners, but for people who know a lot of people who went through grad school, there's a period, sometimes it lasts for the rest of their life, where after they go through grad school, they don't ever want to read anything challenging ever again unless they have to, unless they do it for work or something else. And so their taste in literature and in novels takes a shift. Suddenly they don't want to read literature anymore. They want to read trash. And that's fine. I love trash. Trash makes me so happy. I did the same thing. It took me a long time to want to read novels again after grade school, let alone I don't even read very many good novels anymore. Mostly it's still trash, and so I understand it. And so, like, when I approach board gaming, I don't want to play trash board games, but I'm not there for self-improvement. I'm not there to broaden my social and mental horizons. Again, this doesn't reflect well on me. It's just not why I go to board games. And there are other people, and I have endless respect for this, who treat everything as an opportunity for self-improvement. There are some people with the discipline and character and principle necessary for everything they do. You know, the whole idea of if something's worth doing, it's worth doing well. The idea that, look, this is an opportunity to develop a skill that I don't have. Those people I respect, and thinking about the way they live their lives exhausts me. I know, I mean it. Like, I just can't imagine. There are some things that I take very seriously. Like, I've devoted myself very seriously to the process of having editorial rigor in podcasting. That meant a lot. Took a lot of effort. Various other skills that I've acquired recently. But, I mean, oh, geez. Not in board gaming. What about you, Walker?
Not that I can think of. We did an early episode about, you know, using board game skills in real life scenarios. That, you know, there are some things like organizational and stuff like that. But... nothing major, for sure.
Well, I think you're discounting your recent experience, though.
Oh, true. Rehabilitation, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, you've been using board games and dexterity games in particular as a means of rehabilitation. You've been devoting yourself to that to a tremendous degree, for which I, again, have endless respect. And so this has been an ability for you to have some degree of game mastery all over again. It's a little different, but it's nonetheless apropos.
It's there, So I like what you said about the... when we're talking about game mastery, I think I've... two major things here. It'd be like games where you need to pivot at a certain point, and knowing when to do that pivot and how hard to pivot and when to go. And another way is games that have asymmetric powers or different abilities, and taking advantage of those abilities where, you know, you flip up a card and say, oh, I'm the Red Baron and I get to do this and this and this. And you say, oh, well, I don't like doing that. And you just leave the card to the side and you don't feed into that. And that's not taking advantage of that and using that to, you know, win you the game. Much like Gaia Project. Like, if you don't lean heavily, I'm not saying you have to do that to win.
Right.
But if you don't lean heavily into your power, you're not getting the most out of the game.
Yeah, you're playing suboptimally if you don't exploit the faction asymmetry. Yeah. Well, this leads to, I think, the biggest area of where gamers like us end up in terms of game mastery, which is to say, without consciously doing so, a certain accretion of experience does give you some degree of mastery, some degree of proficiency you get by playing lots of games generally and playing lots of different games in particular. So, for example, you know, going back to any old auction game. Playing an auction game for the first time can be disorienting because you don't know how the economy is going to shake out. But if you've seen lots of different economies shake out, you probably have a bit of a leg up. And this isn't an example of us devoting ourselves to anything. This is just something that happened inevitably as a consequence of our hobby life. And so in that sense, I think that we are getting somewhere towards some degree of mastery, but just in a different way. And going back to a particular example, like, I have a sense of how the tempo of a round of Raw is going to look like. I have a better set of heuristics to determine when it's safe to go out, when it's safe to push, when it's safe to pull back, just by virtue of the fact that I played it dozens of times. And so consequently, I don't need to have quite the same leap of faith that a brand new player might have who might feel that they're the weeds.
Yeah, or games where a sort of a pool is emerging, and there's a certain tile you need or a piece that you need or a card that you want, you know enough that you don't wait, right?
Yeah.
You don't say, oh, well, I'll just get that on my next go around. You know that that card's going to disappear.
Exactly.
You know you're going to have to do whatever it takes to get that this turn or else it's going to be gone.
And that leads to the sort of less interesting corollary of that. I find it more interesting to just have a general sense of experience and intuition, a set of heuristics about overall tempo, about when to seize the initiative. Then there's just knowing stuff in a deck, right? Like another game that I played over 100 times is Race for the Galaxy. So yeah, when I see a card come up, I know because I just remember other cards in the deck that synergize with that. And so yes, by virtue of that and by that alone, setting aside any other experience I might have, I have an advantage over somebody who's never played the game before, who hasn't played as much. That, however, I find to be much less interesting. Just remembering what's in the deck is an advantage that you get inevitably. It's just not a particularly interesting one.
Sometimes it leads into problems as well. There's no evidence. This is hypothetical.
Mm-hmm.
So they say. Like on Board Game Arena, there's a tournament scene.
Yes.
And so there's all sorts of rumors about people two-boxing or quitting,
oh, really?
Quitting games or manipulating the stats in a way that will promote their elo or their spot in the tournament.
Okay, I suppose that shouldn't surprise me.
So that's where it leads into problems.
I hear about gaming groups that maintain things like leaderboards that start awarding, like making a league structure around casual play and like awarding points for wins and draws and things.
Well, we now have Las Vegas board game world competition.
The world board game. That's been going on for a while, yeah. But there at least, I would argue that that's different because there at least it's just an event where you're going to be playing a non-tournament game as though it were a tournament game. Whatever. If you want to go there, that's fine. But the idea of changing the social dynamic of casual board game play.
Oh yeah, that'd be rough.
Super rough. Like, could you imagine what, like, the idea if somebody locally was like, all right, everybody, we're going to start tracking stats. And it's like, oof.
Yeah, you could. And I did non-natural thing. When we were playing Twilight Imperium 4th edition, I started a thing where the winner got to write their name in the lid of the box.
Sure, legacy thing.
And does that not just like change the dynamic as well? Being that person that gets to write your name in.
Oh, really?
You
felt it had an effect?
Yeah, I think so,
really?
Too. And same thing with Risk, like Legacy games.
Yes.
Right? That just changes the whole dynamic as well.
Risk Legacy, although at least, it's weird. We haven't really played a Legacy game where people started getting super competitive. It's partially because, well, in the most recent case, in the case of My Island, it's because we didn't have a solid sense of what the ultimate victory conditions were going to be, and we didn't really have a solid sense about how much rubber banding there was going to be. In the case of Risk Legacy, it's because the game is so facially goofy that everyone was just trying to get the unlocks as fast as possible anyway, rather than actually trying to get the victory.
True, but it's not just that. It's being able to name cities and being the one that gets to do things.
Like, that honestly, I think inspires less of a competitive atmosphere than just a blunt tournament ranking system. Right? Like if it's some weird Benny or some ability to change the flavor of the game, whatever. There you're fighting for influence. It's a weird, different kind of more diffuse kind of cred rather than an explicit sort of, ooh, I'm ranked 2. I need 5 more points to get up to rank 1. I don't know. Like I said, I've only been involved in one tournament environment, and that was Infinity. And again, I didn't even step out because of what the tournament setting was doing. It's because of what my own hang-ups about wins and losses. But I guess the upshot of that is don't try to make an environment where people care about wins and losses.
Yeah, that's where you might come into other problems too, where if you have a group that really wants to play Barrage, and that one group plays a hell of a lot of Barrage, but you play with a bunch of different groups. Now this other group over here suddenly wants to try Barrage out, and you've played it.
Yeah.
And you know what's going on.
Oh, yeah. You know what's what.
That's not going to be an interesting game for you, and it's not going to be an interesting game for them.
I don't know. That depends. But that's one of the virtues of some of the modern Eurogame aesthetics, right? The sort of idiom rather than aesthetics. Like, part of the idea of a well-designed Euro is that players of different skill levels can nonetheless get anything out of the game and not just be totally tabled. Again, sort of the converse of the Infinity problem. When you're losing Infinity, you know you're losing Infinity. If you've got 20 points and the person that you're sitting across from Barrage as $5 million. Now Barrage is not a great example because Barrage is pretty cutthroat for a euro, right? The water's going to disappear.
I'm sure there is a range of games, of course, like you say, that it'll keep things relatively even. But in like a Brass or a Gaia project
That's fair.
A Barrage,
you're right,
man,
you're right.
It's going to be. And
I was wrong. You're
it hasn't
right.
really come up, but watching new players discover the design magic. And I'm sure that can happen like in the group while you're all trying to get better at the game. You can see, oh, he tried a totally different strategy. That was very interesting. But it's not going to come out the same if it's the other scenario where you know you've played it so many times and now you're playing with new people.
Yeah.
It's not going to be as interesting.
No, I agree. It's a bit of an issue. And this leads me to a question I've got for you, Walker, which is very frequently you do something or something happens and you express a considerable degree of frustration. And you explain, and I believe you, that this is because you have certain expectations for yourself. And when those aren't realized, you sometimes get very disappointed in yourself. And that this is independent from your overall ranking in the game. It's usually some sort of specific goal that you have in mind. How does that interact with broader attitudes about game mastery?
I'm not sure very much. I don't think it reflects on the game. I think it just reflects more on myself, and I don't think.
Right, but how do your attitudes about game mastery? How does that intersect with your attitude about what level of mastery you're trying to attain in a particular instance?
Mostly, the mastery I try to at least get to is to be at least a competition to the other players. I don't want to be accidentally taking tiles that are going to king make or destroy a strategy and me take them randomly.
I
do this action because I can't afford this other action for the one sort of strategy that I'm working towards. So instead of taking a lake tile, I have to take a mountain tile.
Right.
And so I accidentally take a mountain tile that someone else needed and I'm just going to be throwing it away or not using it. Right. And so that is the level of mastery that I am going for.
Yeah. I have to share that. I want to make sure, no matter what game I'm playing, that I'm not actively undermining the quality of the experience of other people at the table. And that can be done by my being too incompetent. That can also be done by my being at a different level than everybody else. And obviously, it depends on the game. Yeah.
I got this great line that I found. I got it off. It's not my line. This is someone else's line.
Okay.
Maybe you can reflect on it and or
I'm in a pre-reflective mode.
It says, mastering a game feels like explaining a joke or dissecting a frog. You learn a lot, but it's always lifeless when you're done.
That is interesting. Who said that?
It was off of Reddit.
Okay. Yeah, I'm hard-pressed to disagree, but again, this is speaking from my own sets of preferences. And
yes.
No judgment, no shade on people like, I'm going to get good at this thing. To a certain extent, I envy it, and perhaps I ought to emulate that behavior more, but what can I say? I'm a lazy old man.
Yeah, I enjoy the magic of a group of players finding interesting strategies together, as opposed to one person running away with the game.
Allow me to then finish off with a quote from a very wise man that I know, Woogie. Misplays are interesting. Play faster.
Just so.
Well, that's going to do it for this week. Thank you so much for joining us for So Very Wrong About Games. We appreciate your having spent the time with us, and we hope to see you again soon.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Bickman. You can find all our information at sowronggames.com. Special thanks to What Does It Eat for allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our intro. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. We hope to see you again soon, and as always, try to be right, but remember, you're so very wrong.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours.
Care is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.